The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 356 for Monday, October 3rd, 2011. The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in some questions, you send in some tips, we provide some answers, and together we all learn something new about the Mac and other Apple and other technology, really. Here from Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in, not from, but in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Well, you're coming from Fairfield, Connecticut right now, aren't you?
Currently, yes. Okay. So, I see what you're saying.
But I get what you're saying, because you could be talking about perhaps where you were born or where you grew up, and those places are not necessarily the place where you are right now.
Yeah, I'm not quite as well traveled as you are, but.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it is what it is. So, you know, I mentioned we talk about technology in general, John, and last week, I went down to New York City to attend the launch event, or the announcement event, I should say.
Yeah.
Of the Amazon, well, the whole new Kindle lineup, right? There were four new Kindles. Yeah.
Nice work. I was following you on TMO Live, I think it is, when we do this sort of thing.
Yeah. We did the whole live updates thing. Thanks.
Very impressive. Oh, my gosh.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's going to be, I part of the problem was that they wouldn't let anyone touch these things after, you know, Jeff Bezos came on stage, he did his little dog and pony show, and it was fine. He was fine.
That's unusual.
Yeah. Especially when you invite people to come from, you know, all corners of the globe to this event. It's like, well, dude, you could have put that on the freaking TV. That was a little frustrating, but beyond that, it was a little curious. Like, okay, well, why aren't we allowed to touch it? You know, and it was clearly a PR move. The demoers were like, well, you know, we can't let you do this, and the PR reps were like hawks around there. If you even got within, you know, 6 inches of this thing, they basically would slap your hand away. As politely as possible. They were all very friendly, of course.
Well, my take, if they do that, is that they're afraid that I'll give you my take, is that the device is so fragile and maybe not ready for prime time that they didn't want to let anybody touch it.
That's certainly a reasonable assumption. Either the hardware, the software, or both is not ready for prime time. But, you know, I have another thought about that, is that perhaps they wanted to ensure that the story that is told about this thing for the next 2 months is the story they told us. Right. And I realize I sound a little tinfoil hatty when I say that, but you know, they got on stage, they gave us their, you know, message. Jeff Bezos gave us Amazon's, you know, message about what these devices are, especially the Kindle Fire, because it's this 7-inch sort of, you know, there's this gap between laptop and smartphone, right? And the iPad sits sort of what I would consider at the high end of that gap. And this Kindle Fire sits a little closer to the smartphone than the laptop, right? Because it's a little smaller and presumably a little slower and all that. But they did not want us digging and talking about other things that either aren't ready, like you said, or perhaps just not part of what they want the conversation to be about for the next 2 months. So that'll be interesting. They were really keen on mentioning that this thing will fit comfortably in one hand. And so I sat and watched one of the product demonstrators, and I watched him like a hawk for about 5 minutes straight with my eye just, and he had the thing in his left hand, and he was, you know, no problem. He had kind of fingers on either edge of the device. He was holding it in portrait mode and, you know, manipulating it because it's got a touchscreen with the right hand. And I figured if he was there to show us that this thing worked great in one hand, but it didn't, that at some point he would stumble or falter or, you know, have to readjust because it was terribly uncomfortable. And he never did that in the period of time that I was watching him. So I would have to assume that this thing actually does at least in a sense, fit comfortably in one hand, which is good, you know, but it'll be interesting. We've got one on order. We'll get one either when they come out, or if Amazon wants to send us one ahead of time, we'll take a look at it. But it's an interesting device. I think they'll sell a ton of them. I think they'll sell a lot of them to people that want iPads, but don't want to buy iPads. You know, the people that think they want iPads, but aren't actually ready to spend the money on an iPad. I mean, for $200, it's a much easier purchase to justify.
Okay. And yeah, so I think in a nutshell, what they did is they announced three Kindles, ebook Kindles, right?
E-ink based Kindles, right. I mean, you can read on the Kindle Fire too. So, you know, important distinction is really just the screen, not so much that, I mean, you know, it's not like you can't read on the Kindle Fire, but it is not e-ink. It's a, you know, LCD
right.
screen or
color
yeah.
LCD.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so it looks like a potential iPad competitor. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, iPad competitor, of course, that's a loaded term because people get all, you know, up in knots about that. I think at some level, as I said, it will be for those people that want an iPad but will not spend the money for an iPad. If someone's willing to spend the money for an iPad, I think they'll probably opt to get the iPad as opposed to the Kindle Fire. In that sense, I don't necessarily see it competing, but we have to see these devices. I mean, I'm making a lot of assumptions because, you know, we have limited information, which is sort of a drag, but that's how it goes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I checked you out. So you took my travel suggestion, or at least you,
take your travel suggestion. Yeah.
I've come to visit you, I've driven and I've taken the train, and I like, Amtrak, and I especially like the Acela, but now, and so you did that. And I guess for where you're coming from, I guess it wasn't totally convenient for you to get to the train station in Boston. Right. But it dumped you right where you needed to be in New York City. So.
Yeah, that was the right. Exactly. I drove to the train and it was about, I actually chose to drive to the Route 128 station, which isn't in downtown Boston, but easier to park there and easier to get out of there if I were to come back during, you know, rush hour or something. As it turns out, I was back earlier than I expected. But yeah, it was, I drove down whatever it was, the hour and change to the train station, but then Amtrak brings me right to Penn Station in New York. And the event was, I don't know, 3 or 4 blocks from there. So I just walked.
Yeah.
It was good.
And I was surprised. So apparently they've added Wi-Fi because last time I took the Acela, they did not have, they had power outlets, I think as do most trains, but that's neat. Yeah, we were chatting on that. I took the train too, and then we'll move on to some questions. I actually took the train to New York City over the weekend to go to a photo walk, and we were blessed yesterday with very nice weather, and I was in the Red Hook section of Brooklyn. Very, very nice.
Cool. You'll put some pictures up on your website that will have to go away once Mobile Me dies. But we'll be able to see it until then.
You know, actually, this event, and I think probably what I'm going to migrate to, and I already post some things here, but Flickr to me looks like the best replacement for posting my pictures, and also the leader of the group set up, you know, a special group where you can post your pictures, and it integrates with Aperture, integrates with Flickr. So I think I'm going to move my stuff or republish it to Flickr, I think is going to be my final decision. Though you told me about that WordPress thing, so I may experiment with that as well. But
yeah.
Still got a little time, right?
Of course. Yeah. All right. Andy writes, the subject of how to move a time machine backup was so totally topical for me as I was doing the very same thing this week. I bought a new Airport Extreme and planned to plug in my present portable backup drive to the Airport Extreme and continue my backup as normal. I soon found out that this is not possible for all the reasons that we talked about, because the backup was set up to be local and not networked. Also realized that I should have either purchased a time capsule or an additional backup drive instead. So I have some related questions. As I travel all the time, how can I A, have a home-based backup on the time capsule, and B, have a mobile backup to carry with me when I travel? Ideally, I should be able to plug the same laptop into the home Airport Extreme and then unplug and carry with me when I travel. Can you help? He actually said, however, ideally I should be able to plug the same portable into the home Airport Extreme. So I'm not sure if you meant portable computer or portable drive. So we'll talk about both. If you want to take the same drive with you, that is possible. The first thing you need to do is plug your, portable drive into your Time Capsule or Airport Extreme and start the backup to that. You don't necessarily need to let it finish, as we discussed in I think it was the last show, but you need to let it start so that you get a sparse bundle created out on that drive. You got to wait till the progress meter comes up for the first backup. Once you've done that, then you can either let it finish or not, and you can plug it into your computer or into the Time Capsule, and it'll work fine. But here's the thing. I don't believe the system is going to do it automatically. If you move the hard drive from your Time Capsule or Airport Extreme to your plug directly into your Mac via USB, your Mac will not see that as the backup destination, because your Mac says, I know I'm backing up to a drive that's attached to a network device. So you're going to have to go into the Time Machine preferences on your Mac and just swap it back and forth. I don't believe you're going to be able to do it automatically with the OS, but I believe you can use something like Marco Polo, or help me, John, what's the name of that other app similar to Marco Polo? Is it the Airport
Location?
That's the one. Yep. So both of those apps will take a series of, they essentially have sensors. They check to see what's the name of your Wi-Fi network. What's, you can build sort of criteria. And if a set of criteria is met, it then goes and changes a bunch of settings. And perhaps you can use one of those to change your Time Machine settings back and forth. I don't know. I haven't tried it, but that would be the only way I could think of to automate it. Otherwise, you just got to go and change it manually but you're doing it manually anyway, because you're either plugging the drive into your Mac or you're plugging the drive into the Time Capsule, in which case, you're doing some part of the process. Hopefully you can do the rest. That's my thought anyway.
I have one final thought. I wonder if it'd be useful to look at something like Dolly Drive, because I believe Dolly Drive will do this in the background. I think it's a little smarter about it than you having to manually switch things back and forth.
Well, Dolly Drive backs up to their cloud.
But I thought I'll have to review their, but I thought it had ability to also do it locally.
I think the local backup with Dolly Drive is a clone only. I don't think it's a Time Machine backup. I think it's just a clone.
Oh,
I think unless something with Dolly Drive has changed that I'm unaware of. But that's how it was initially. Okay.
I haven't actually tried it. I just seem to recall that they can go to both the cloud and to a local backup.
Right.
So.
Right.
Yeah, I have to play with that. I know I have a code somewhere, yeah, buried somewhere to give it a whirl. Yeah. It's in the pile.
Cool. All right. Let's go to, and I hope I'm pronouncing, well, you're going to pronounce your name for me. Kyron, I believe, is how we pronounce his name, and a question in the last show and a completely different question in this show.
Hi, John and Dave. This is Owen Pilot Pete. No, I can't forget Pete. This is Kyron here from Dublin in Ireland. And one more quick question for you, if you don't mind, which is really the new mail in Lion. One of the things I've noticed is I use two IMAP accounts, one Gmail and one MobileMe, and which were working fine with junk mail prior to upgrading to Lion. And if you know, when you normally get a mail that appears in your junk folder, you kind of get a little section that says, junk mail, not junk mail, or I think it's not junk or something like that is the button that you can click. Once you click that button, it usually pops that mail that was incorrectly moved to the junk mail folder back into your inbox. And this feature seems to have disappeared since I've upgraded to Lion on both my MacBook Pro and an iMac 24-inch. And it's a little bit frustrating because sometimes mail does seem to grab or flag junk mail incorrectly and moves it to the junk mail folder. And it was always quite handy just to hit not junk and it would move it back to the inbox. So I have upgraded a friend's computer as well, but that was in clean install of Snow Leopard up to Lion and it didn't seem to happen. So I'm sure there's a setting somewhere that re-enables it. So it allows me to actually correct mail or actually try and teach it that some of these folders or some of these incoming mails are not junk. I hope that wasn't too much of a ramble and you made some sort of sense. Thanks very much, guys. And this is where you cut me off.
All right, Kyron, I think we know what you're going after. So, yeah, The UI of how to deal with this in Lion has changed slightly. If you go to mail preferences and go to junk mail, first you've got to make sure enable junk mail filtering is on. That's obviously step one. If that's not on, then it's not going to do any of this. And then you want to set it to when junk mail arrives, you want to have it move it to the junk mailbox. Otherwise, it's just going to stay in the inbox and what you're looking for is sort of irrelevant. So presumably you've got both of those set. If you do, then what you need to do is customize your toolbar. If you go to the view menu in Mail and go to customize toolbar, there is now, instead of a junk and not junk button, there is a thumbs up. And that thumb, or actually, I guess in the when you're in that setting, it's actually thumbs down. And that thumbs down is how you tell Mail it's junk. Now, I realize that's not exactly what you're looking for, but bear with me. Drag that into your toolbar and put it somewhere. When you have highlighted a message that Mail thinks is not junk, it is a thumbs down. When you have highlighted a message that Mail thinks is junk, however, it turns into a thumbs up and its process is reversed. It will tell Mail, no, this is not junk, and it will undo whatever Mail did it. So it will not flag it as junk, and then it will put it back in your inbox. Do you use Mail's junk? And hopefully that works for you, Kyron. Do you use Mail's junk filtering, or do you still just spam sieve? Is that right, John?
That's correct. And you know, it does something very similar. So every now and then I'll see something in the spam folder. So it has an explicit spam folder.
Yep.
And every now and then, so one, it color codes things, which is kind of cool as far as the spamminess of something.
Huh.
And sometimes you can help it. So sometimes if something is on the border of being spam, if you highlight it and then say mark as spam, it'll bring that into its intelligence to say, oh, okay. But also, if something appears in the spam folder and it's not, then what you do is you highlight and they add menu choices and you say mark is good, and then it'll do the same thing. It'll take it out of the spam folder and put it back in your inbox. So very similar model, I think.
Cool. All right. I want to talk about our first sponsor for the show, which is Smile Software. This month, we get to talk about Text Expander and Text Expander Touch. In fact, I think actually, if I remember the agenda correctly, we're actually going to talk about Text Expander as part of an answer later. But Text Expander is a pretty cool app. What it does is it allows you to customize shortcuts. So you type it, for example, for me, and this is a very rudimentary example, but you can go much further than this. For me, if I type 0603, now 603 is my area code, it automatically fills in my office phone number. I do the same with C603. I also have it, if I type DHADD, it fills in my address. And I even have, John, I have your address in my Text Expander snippet. So if I type JBADD, it fills in your address. And that's great. You know, when someone says, oh, I want to send you guys something, I can just fill this stuff in and I don't have to think about it. I don't have to go to the address book. I don't have to look it up. It's right there. I've built it into Text Expander and I'm good to go. It syncs with Dropbox. So I can have it on all of my Macs without having to think about it. And you can do really cool things. I can have it insert the contents of the clipboard. So if, for example, I put a URL on the clipboard, I could build a little snippet in Text Expander that says, please visit this URL to check out the coverage that we did of your product, for example. And boom, if I copy the URL to the clipboard, I go into my email, I type the little shortcut for it, and maybe it's just, you know, PM or comma PM for product mention, and then boom, it fills it out and I've got the whole thing right there and I don't have to worry about it. And the URL is auto pasted in. I can have it paste the time, the date. I can even have it run little scripts. So it's really a cool geeky tool. And if you're not using it, frankly, I don't know how you'd use a computer without it, these days. You can download a demo. If you go to smilesoftware.com, it comes right there. You can just download. And after you're convinced with the free trial that you want it, it's $35 or $34.95 US. So great for using email signatures and all of that stuff. It's just one of those things. I can't imagine not using it on every Mac that I have. They also have Text Expander Touch, which when you use it with apps that support it, it's really cool. And it does the same thing, and you can get your same snippets over there and all of that good stuff. Lots of Twitter clients use it, you know, Twittolator Pro, Usfora. You can use it with the WordPress app, the BlogPress app, Express for WordPress, GV Mobile Plus supports it. All these different apps, and we'll put a link in the show notes so that you can see where it all goes. Simple Note uses it. So if you use Simple Note, which is another great little iOS app and service, Text Expander Touch will work with that. That's available, of course, from the iOS App Store for $4.99. But you can go to smilesoftware.com and learn all about both these great apps. And I highly encourage you to do so. I think you will, if you don't already use Text Expander, take a minute and go check it out. It's well worth your time to explore the free trial, and I have no doubt you'll love it. So that's Text Expander and Text Expander Touch from smilesoftware.com. And now we will spend a moment revisiting a topic, because we've done something on it here that will make life a little bit easier for you. Kevin writes, why has my iMac stopped automatically sleeping? I have a 2008 iMac and it's set to sleep after 45 minutes of inactivity, but it does not do it. Wake for network access is turned off. This has been going on for about a month with no particular triggering installation. I've tried closing all apps to no avail. None of them are keeping it awake that I know of. I have scrapped the power management plist file, as you guys have previously discussed. In the console, the one thing I've found is that something occurring every few minutes, and John's going to tell us what that is, because yet again, Mr. Braun didn't include the screenshot here for me. What is it that the file sharing thing says? I think it's something about SMB, right? Windows sharing is trying to connect.
Oh, the message he was getting. Yeah. The firewall, it was, SMBD was the process, and something from a certain IP address was trying to connect on port 139.
Interesting.
And it just kept repeating that message, which, yeah, I thought was kind of weird.
So that's,
and that he said he didn't have Windows file sharing on, so I don't know why he would be getting this message, but I don't think that's what's causing the problem.
No, it's not. But I will say, in a situation like that where clearly it's on, right? I mean, the SMB daemon is running and reporting things to the console. I don't think that's related to his problem here, but I think it's worth turning it, making sure it's off. And the way I would do that is I would go into system preferences sharing, and I would turn it on, and then quit system preferences, come back in and turn it off. Because sometimes the checkbox in system preferences may not reflect the state of the system. And by checking it, you're kind of reinitializing the whole process, and then unchecking it should undo all of that and turn it off. That would be, and that may be causing sleep issues. I don't know, but that would be one thing.
Yeah. I mean, just another computer being connected over the network, I don't think that prevents you from going to sleep.
No, but if the SMB server is running, actually having another computer connected will prevent it from going to sleep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But even if it's not, if the SMB server is running and it's not quite right, which clearly it's not, because it's not showing up as the checkbox. I mean, there could be some setting with it that it just needs to be wiped out. That would be my thought. But there is another way to find out what's keeping your computers awake, isn't there, John?
Absolutely. And in the past, we've recommended an Apple article that would tell you all the possible things that would prevent sleep. But that's exhaustive, and it doesn't really give you the answer. Well, thanks to an article here from MGG Jim. Hi, Jim. getting right down to it, Dave. The PM set command will tell you what's prevented sleep. And we'll link to the article, but very quickly, if you do PM set -G, there will be a line in what is reported that will say sleep, and then this kind of cryptic thing, sleep 0, and then in parentheses, imposed by, and this mysterious number. And what is this mysterious number, you may ask yourself, Dave?
I'm asking myself that right now. What is that mysterious number?
Here's the mysterious number. Like in this case, it was 173, though it could be anything. It's the process ID of what prevented the Mac from going to sleep. Now, that would make you ask, well, how do I find out what the process ID of what's causing the thing not to sleep is? And there are two ways to do it. So one is there is a terminal command here that you can do, and it's in the article, ps --ax --vertical bar, which is a pipe, --grep --.
They're not going to remember that. Just they can read it in the article, which is why it's there, which is why we're doing these MGG Answers articles, and they're freaking awesome.
If I now, the other thing you could do, of course, last I checked, of course they're awesome. Yeah. There are, of course, the other way to find the process ID, Dave, which I think is a bit more straightforward, is you go in Activity Monitor. Yep. And in the left-hand column is PID. And if you click on that, it'll sort. And then you can also see what process. Yep. And like in the example, it showed, what was it?
It was iTunes.
iTunes, oh, yes. No. So I guess iTunes, or it was an audio daemon, right?
It was Core Audio D in the example that I put into this article with Jim. And what it was is, iTunes tells the system to play audio. And so the system launches this separate little process to actually make the audio happen, because that's how Mac OS X works. As soon as I stopped playback in iTunes, my sleep, there was no more imposed by in parentheses, and my sleep went back to 60 minutes or, whatever it was set to previously. Which is awesome. It's great. I think this is a Lion only thing. I tried this on Snow Leopard and I couldn't get it to tell me. I couldn't get the imposed by thing to appear for sleep. I had it appearing for something else. It might have been display sleep or disk sleep or something like that. But regular sleep was not showing up as an imposed by thing in Snow Leopard. So this is new in Lion. So yeah, good stuff. We've had a lot of good MGG Answers articles recently. Just put one up about Skype power tips. One that's awesome is, well, we just talked about it in the last show, how to decide if you need more RAM. We've got, I'm looking at the queue here. We're going to talk about some of these. So let's move on. But check them out. This is something we've wanted to do for a while. I know I ranted about it in the last show, but I'm very excited that we're finally doing these and publishing them. And now there's more in the system than I know what to do with, which is fantastic, because we figure out what to do with them is we post them is what we're doing. So at least one a day is going up now at the pace that we're going. And if we can keep it up, we will.
Wow.
Yeah. All right. Let's go to Steve and see what he says.
Hi guys. This is Steve from Okinawa, Japan. I have a question about a problem running a application. It stopped running under my username. I made a new username and it runs under that name. The app is Parallels. First 6 wouldn't run, so I upgraded to 7 and that wouldn't run either. I repaired permissions several times using disk utility. I also went to the command line. Is it hdutil to repair permissions? I also did the Lion boot into recovery partition, and then change password, and then you go to the reset users permissions or something like that. I'm sure you know what that is.
So I do know what it is. In fact, we did an MGG Answers article about that because you cannot resetting permissions in OS X. Only reset system level permissions. If you want to reset user permissions, you have to reset those with a special utility. And we'll point to an article about that too.
I've tried really everything. I even deleted preps for Parallels. I reinstalled Parallels, uninstalled and reinstalled it several times. And like I said, it runs under a new username, the account that I made, but I can't get it to run under my account. So I either want to fix it so it runs under my account or make a new account and safely move everything over and then get rid of my existing account. I hope that you would address this. And I have talked with Parallels support and they went back and forth and then they gave up and said, please contact Apple, which I have not done yet. Thank you.
All right, Steve, let's see what we can do here. So I would be surprised if Parallel Support didn't have you do these things, but you didn't mention them. So we'll throw it out there. In a general sense, what we're about to talk about here is good troubleshooting, especially once you've done the level of troubleshooting you've done, Steve, where you've figured out that it works in one user account, but not the other. So we know for almost absolute certain that whatever is stopping Parallels from running for you is happening in your user account. So with that in mind, there are a couple of places to look. The first place to start is the library folder. Now, I'm talking about your user library folder. So, and everything we're talking about is going to be inside your home folder. So you need to get to the library folder. In Snow Leopard, that's easy. You go to your home folder and you click on library. In Snow Leopard, in Lion, it's not easy, of course, because you can't get there. So hold down the option key, or you don't see it. In the Finder, hold down the option key, go to the Go menu and choose Library. Holding down the option key will make that appear for you. Once you're there, first place to check is the Parallels folder. So just Library Parallels, or Home Library Parallels. And I would, with all of these, save one. I would just trash them. Don't empty the trash, but just put them in the trash. Get them out of the way. So there's that one. Then there is Library Caches. And there's a file there called com.parallels.desktop.console, I believe. But really anything you see with com.parallels in caches, get rid of it. Same for home library preferences. Anything you see with com.parallels, and there's going to be probably 8 of them in here, get them out of the way. Home library preferences parallels. There is a parallels folder inside the preferences folder. Get rid of that. You're probably all seeing a pattern here. We're digging around in where applications typically store things. Now, the other place that you would look for most apps is home library application support. On my testing, and I do run Parallels, I did not find anything about Parallels in application support. It seems to barf its stuff elsewhere. Frankly, it probably should put it in application support, but it doesn't. So, you know, I'm glad I looked elsewhere. But that's, you know, but it would not be surprising to find stuff in there, for other apps. Now, lastly, with Parallels, there's one more folder, and it's the folder that holds your virtual machines. Now this is not something you want to delete kind of willy nilly. It's in Home Documents Parallels by default, unless you've chosen to put it somewhere else. And these files can be very, very large, you know, several gigabytes a piece easily, one for each virtual machine. And they could get, you know, huge, 30, 40 gigabytes, depending on how much data you wind up putting out on your virtual drives. So I would move the virtual machines out of that folder. But first, I would get rid of everything else first. As we said, put it in the trash, don't empty it. And now try to launch Parallels. If it launches, then you're good to go. But if it doesn't, then try moving these virtual machines out of your documents folder. But again, don't delete them, because that's where all your data is. But again, they are stored in your home folder. So it's, you know, we're just kind of, in a general sense, we're looking for everything about this app that's stored in that folder to see what of them is causing the trouble. So that's how we roll with that. Do you have anything to add to that, John?
Haven't been using Parallels lately.
No, I mean, just in general, kind of, you know, any other places you would look if you knew an app was not launching because of something in your home folder, not necessarily Parallels, but really anything. It's, you know, caches, preferences, application support, and the root of the library folder, you know.
Possibly. Oh, gosh. Launch daemons.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Sometimes you get stuff that there are a couple of them. Let me bring it up here.
Yeah.
I think library, and there are various ones. So, launch agents and launch daemons, I think, are a couple of other places where stuff that's related to proper starting up of an app may live. And if it's not there. Right. Yeah, I think that's the two: launch agents, launch daemons, both in your home folder. And well, in this case, I would think it's the home folder. And right home. Now I'm looking in mine and I just see home agent or launch agents,
home library folder. Right.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Just wanted to be clear about that. Cool. All right. Then we will move on to Mark. Mark writes, I have two external FireWire drives hooked up to my mid-2008 iMac. One of the drives is my Time Machine drive, and the other I use for a nightly clone using Carbon Copy Cloner. If my Mac has been left on for a while, then the iMac does not go to sleep, but the drives do spin down in accordance with my system preference settings. When I return to it, I then have to wait for the two FireWire drives to spin back up, one after the other, usually rather than both at the same time, before the system will act upon my mouse click. I can understand why my system drive needs to spin up, obviously, but I have no idea why the iMac insists on also waking up the two external FireWire drives before it responds to my clicking. I tried my own bit of Google foo, as you put it, John, but I clearly am not a black belt yet. I'm running Lion 1071 and everything is kept up to date religiously. Is there any way I can keep the FireWire drives sleeping until they are called upon for their respective tasks by the system and prevent them from spinning up whenever I need to use the machine? Thanks so much for any guidance and, of course, for the guidance you've given in your shows to date. All right, John, why don't you take this one and then we'll pass it around.
The answer is yes. There is a way to prevent them from spinning up.
Really?
Yes, there is.
Go.
Eject them before you put the... I'm being serious.
That's true.
That is the answer. No, I have noticed this. So first off, it's not a Lion issue. I noticed this on my Snow Leopard machine and my Lion machine.
And it happened in Leopard too. I think prior to Leopard, there was slightly more asynchronicity with this stuff.
By the police? Asynchronous. Oh, that was synchronicity.
That's right.
Right. But as far as I can tell, the default behavior of the Finder is when you wake a machine up, it's going to do a survey of any drives that it sees connected to the system. And in order to do that, it has to spin them up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's everything I saw. I mean, I noticed that, you know, as of late, although now I'm on the Drobo, but I had very recently an external drive in a FireWire 800 enclosure on the Mini, and I would sleep the Mini, and every time I woke it up, I would hear that drive spin up. So I there may be some enclosures that let you control that or drive firmware, depending on the drive itself, that may prevent that. But from what I've seen, it's hard to prevent that. Short of ejecting the drive. If the drive is not seen by the computer, then it's not going to spin it up because it's not there. Now, this is a problem, though, because what if you do have a scheduled task like a Time Machine backup or Carbon Copy Cloner or Super Duper?
Well,
now, I found a number of options. So, and I know where you're going, so I'll hand it to you after I say I'm doing here. So number one is that you can, and I'm going to link to it. It's a hint over at Macworld. One thing is you could write an Automator script. Automator within the Finder section has a command to mount a drive and a command to unmount a drive.
And for those of you following along at home, mount and unmount, unmount is the same as eject. And mount is what happens automatically with most drives when you plug them in, that they just appear in the Finder.
Now, here is the trick, though. And this is the only tricky thing about this is that normally... or at least most people think, and this is why you listen to us, or this is why I found this tip. But the thing is, normally the only way to get a drive to mount itself after you've ejected it is to power it off and power it on again. Now, obviously, you're not going to be doing that all the time. The little secret here is that the mount command, it requires a little bit of extra information. And this article goes into detail, but basically it needs to know, I think it's the Unix device code or where it's mapped in the Unix file system. And I think you say something, mount and then /dev/ and some code that the article tells you how to obtain, and then the name of the volume, and it will mount it. So, and that surprised me the first time and I've seen tips like this in the past, but it surprised me that there was a way other than cycling power on the drive to get it to appear on the desktop once you've ejected it.
Oh, John, let me enlighten you here. Because
I know you're going to build on this, but that's one way to do it. And that's a general purpose solution is write an Automator script and either run it yourself or you may be able to get it to time itself, to schedule it, to do first the mount and then running your backup program. But go, because you got more.
I do. So for your general purpose drive mounting, certainly, you know, I am a big fan of doing things from the command line, but it can be a pain in the neck. And frankly, mounting is something I avoid at all costs from the command line because the syntax to do it is arcane. I need to remember, like you said, what the device ID is and what partition it is on that device and what the mount point is and all of that stuff. It's fine if you, you know, if you do the research or you know what it is, but it can be a pain in the neck. So Disk Utility to the rescue. Launch Disk Utility and you can mount and unmount drives right in there with a single click. You highlight the drive and choose mount or choose unmount. There's a little at the top of Disk Utility in the little toolbar, there's a mount and an unmount icon. So that's one way of doing it manually. Now, as far as his question, now he says he's using this for two purposes. As you said, Time Machine. I don't have a magic answer for that.
Oh, but and what that will do?
Yeah.
I just want to add some info. Also in Disk Utility, here's the other thing, is that if you click on the drive and you you do a right click or control click, there's going to be an information section, one of the pieces of information. So here's what it's called, the disk identifier. So like, for example, the disk identifier in the drive of my Mac Mini is disk 0S2.
Right. So it's disk that would be disk 0 partition 3, I think, right? Isn't that how it works? And that 0, 1, and 2. I don't know. But that's why I don't. That's why I don't do it from the terminal.
Right.
It's a pain in the neck. And you've also got to tell it if you want to mount it, read, write, and all that other stuff. Isn't there? There's some more switches you need to do at the command line with that. But anyway, do it in Disk Utility if you don't want to learn the terminal command, and it works just fine. The other thing he mentioned that the second drive is being used for his daily carbon copy clone. I use SuperDuper. You mentioned SuperDuper. It has a feature that is purpose-built for exactly what you and, frankly, I want to do because I got sick and tired of waiting for my drive to spin up, too. What you can do is you set your SuperDuper schedule for, whatever you want to do, but you set after the backup completes or after the clone or whatever it calls it completes, eject the drive, and it will eject the drive and then quit SuperDuper. It also remembers where that drive is. So the next day when SuperDuper launches, it remounts the drive for you, backs up to it or clones to it, and then unmounts it again. So the drive's not sitting on your desktop. You're not worried about Spotlight potentially grabbing it. Although SuperDuper should set the Spotlight state on that drive to maintain its exclusion. But it really, really handy to do it that way. And for you know, I know Carbon Copy Cloner is free and SuperDuper is not. But perhaps that's enough to make it worth the price. I know for me it was the thing that made me jump to SuperDuper.
You know, looking here, so almost live, but I got an email back from Mark, and apparently the latest version of Carbon Copy Cloner, I think it's 3.4.3, are they up to? Yes.
Yep.
Has in the scheduled section a before copying files and a after copying files. It looks a bit more primitive. It looks like you have to run a shell script.
Okay.
So it's not quite as nice as SuperDuper, but I think they got the inspiration because
sure.
People have run into, this is an old problem. So,
It sucks. It drives me crazy, to have those drives, you know, wait for them to spin up. I'm totally with you, Mark. Yeah. All right. Is it time to, where are we here? Time wise? Whoa. Holy cow. I want to talk about our second sponsor. It's Gazelle. At gazelle.com, there's some little event happening over there in Cupertino tomorrow. So there's probably going to be some iPhone released. And last week, you know, as we mentioned, they announced new Kindles coming. Well, what if you have the old one or the existing one, but you want to get the new one because you're a geek and you want the latest and greatest? You can do that. But now what do you do with the old one? Well, you go to gazelle.com. And you type in what you have, the model, the condition, all of that. And Gazelle will tell you, here's how much we'll give you for it. It's pretty cool. And then with most stuff, they'll pay for shipping. And also with most stuff, they'll even send you a box if you like. And you pack your thing into the box. You ship it off at their cost. They get it. They evaluate it, make sure it is what you said it was. And they send you your money. If it's not. If their opinion is that it's different, either better or worse than what you said, they'll give you the opportunity to either take whatever their offer is or decline, and they'll ship it back to you again at their cost. Gazelle's had over 200,000 customers. They've been around a while, and it's really cool. It's actually a lot of fun. I find myself going to gazelle.com anytime I pick up a little gadget around that, you know, if I'm cleaning my office, like, oh, this old iPod, let me see. And sometimes, you know, it's like, hey, you know, you get some money out of it. All right, great. And it's better than having it sitting around. So you're turning those piles of gadgets into cash. And cash is good because then with the cash, you can pay your credit card bill for the new iPhone or the new Kindle or whatever it is. So check it out, gazelle.com. And the sooner you get there, the better. Because you know, my guess is that over time, the prices of these things usually go down. Though, of course, there's some little things that cause prices on used stuff to spike. But check it out, gazelle.com. That's where I go to dump all my old stuff off. And I highly recommend them. It's a pleasure to have sponsors that we can actually recommend. And Gazelle's certainly one of them. Is it time to, let's see, why don't we go to Michael here? I want to make sure we get through a couple of these things.
Okay.
I'm looking here. No, you know what? Let's go to Adam.
Oh.
Adam, this is good stuff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. All right. So Adam writes, I have a small studio setup where users store their files locally on their Macs running Leopard and also on a central Mac Pro server running Snow Leopard server. I know that when these users delete something that's on the server, they're presented with the all too familiar, your file will be deleted immediately message. I was wondering whether there's a way to set things up in Snow Leopard servers so that these users can open, edit, and save files as usual on the server, but be prevented from actually deleting them. This would help my workflow immensely, as I have users who are not particularly tech savvy and currently rely on shielding these users from important files and careful guidance and training to avoid them accidentally deleting or overwriting anything. So this is similar to our network delete that I think we discussed in the last show, right, John? But go ahead.
So, you know, there is a way. So I'm going to address the specific question of, is there a way to prevent a file from being deleted on a network volume?
Yeah.
And the answer is yes, though I'm not really happy with my answer here. So I was able to find the answer, Dave.
Yep.
But I don't like it. And I'm going to make another suggestion. But first, I'm going to give you the observation. And this actually happened because I was clearing out one of my network drives the other day. Or, you know, I got the new Drobo here and I was, you know, cleaning things up and I wanted to get rid of a folder full of stuff I didn't need anymore. So, you know, of course, it was a network volume. I deleted it. And then all of a sudden, a message came up saying the operation can't be completed because you don't have permission to access some of the items. And I'm like, what? It's my stuff. How can I not have permission? I'm administrator. I'm the man. Here's what it was eventually. So then I look in that folder and I see on the icon, a tiny little, because I have the size of the icon really small, I saw a little lock. Where does that little lock come from? I'll tell you where it comes from. If you get info on a file, you can lock the file and that limits access to it. If for whatever reason, network, for the most part, if files are locked, then you delete them on the local volume. You'll either get, I think in Lion, it just creams them. And in Snow Leopard, I think it'll say, oh, well, I see some locked and unlocked. But so it doesn't look like it's reliable for local volumes, but for a network trash. My experience is that you'll get this message saying it's like a permission issue. So you could make a workflow where you lock, you ask people to lock files when they're done with them. But to me, that's kind of a hack. All right.
Yep.
So I answered his question, but I don't like the answer. What I really would suggest is, so it sounds like what's happening here is that the workflow involves manipulating folders and files. And if you're going to be doing any sort of projects that involves lots of files all over the place and people have ownership of them and they're editing and all that, what I really am going to suggest is that you get something known as a content management system. We use one in Mac Observer. I believe we use something called Expressions Engine, which is more, you know, web page based, right?
Yeah, well, that's a web publishing system. What you'd want to go
But there are others which I would say are more general in that I'll call them content management systems because they're not really geared towards it. Right. So Expressions is specific to websites and there are some others. And I gave him the name of a few and we'll link to them. I found them. But the idea is that you have a system that can manage projects that consists of a group of files.
Yeah, I think something like, you know, a version control system would be the trick, right? Checking files in and out.
Version control. And I want to be I want to differentiate the two is that to me, a version control system is something that's more for software people in that it'll handle pieces of source code. And there are some, like one I know that's popular that's open source is called Subversion.
Yep.
In the Microsoft world, there's something called SourceSafe. CVS is another one. But those, I think, are more geared to handling source code that's used to build software. When I think of something called a content management system, that's a bit more generic. And then I think you certainly
I would be careful with that term, too, because CMS really refers to publishing on the web. I mean, that if you research content management system, you're going to find WordPress and Expression Engine and, you know, Drupal and Joomla and all of that. So I'm just wondering if you have a specific example of what this person could use.
Well, I found some others that didn't seem to be okay. Web focused.
Yeah,
there,
maybe that's just my prejudice, right? Showing up here because anytime somebody says CMS to me, I think, oh, that's, you know, web publishing. But
no, you're right. But I saw some others here that I hadn't used them. So actually, this will be a call to, like, I found a few here, like one called Plone.
Okay.
And another called Mambo, which looked to be more generic in that they managed group of files and weren't necessarily meant to only publish things to the web. Joomla certainly is. I've used Joomla, and that's, for the most part, I think something that manages content that you publish to the web.
Right.
So,
right.
So actually, I'd be curious because I know. Back in my corporate gig, Quark had something that was, I think, a general system that would manage, and the graphic artists would use it, and it would manage projects that consisted of graphic files for the most part.
I think Adobe has that, right, called Adobe Versions or something like that, right, as one of them?
They could. So that's a space that I'm not really familiar with, but I want to present the concept. So version control system, again, is more for software, and I mentioned a few. We'll link to them. As you're saying, Dave, I think, now that I think about it, that may be not the right term because I think, as you say, CMS implies web-based. And then I think there are just general systems, like Adobe and Quark, and I'll dig around and see if I can find some to put in the...
Check out something, and I'm just pulling this up now, but there is something called HyperOffice, which is a document version control system. So that, you know, that might be something else to look at.
Yeah. So I think you want to get a more structured workflow.
Yeah.
Because what they all do, though, is embrace the concept of allowing a user to take a file and check it into the server. And once it's in the server... Unless you explicitly delete it, which they typically, a lot of them don't even let you, it'll maintain it for you. And the other thing is that when you have a group of files, a lot of times the group of files is used to make something, and especially with software, once you have so many files, sometimes it's almost impossible to remember which version of a file, whether it be source code or a digital file, was used to create the end product. And that's what these systems do very well. So
what's interesting is if you look, and John, you'd even find this on your Drobo, the folder itself is hidden, but if you look, you will see it is a folder called the network trash folder. And it sure sounds like that's what Adam's looking for. Now, the problem is it is what Adam's looking for, but it's only there for clients of OS 9 and I think OS 10.0 and maybe 10.1. After that, the network trash folder is no longer used. It's seen by OS 10 and it's hidden, but it's not used in that way. On some things, and you might be able to do this on Snow Leopard server, Adam, is you create a folder at the root level of whatever the share is called .trashes with a capital T. And then you make the folder owned by root, writable by everyone. And that on a Snow Leopard server machine, that may actually do what you're looking for. It may allow people to store trash on the network drive, but you've got to manually create that. And that might work. There's no guarantees. And of course I don't have a server machine up because the power supply died in my Leopard server machine, my dual G4. So I could not test that for you, but that's certainly an option and worth trying out So we'll put a link in the show notes. Earlier today, I found an article about it that tells you exactly how to set the permissions if you're not comfortable doing that. But chances are, if you're managing a Snow Leopard server, you are. So try that. .trashes with a capital T, and set it so that everyone can write to it and it's owned by root. And then I think your users are going to have to unmount that drive and remount it before OS 10 will see that .trashes folder. So just include that into your testing workflow. Don't get frustrated if you create that folder and it doesn't work immediately. I did try it on my Drobo today, and it did not work, which is sort of a drag because it would have been nice if it did. But he's running Snow Leopard server. So,
and a final suggestion.
Yeah, go.
Because it's kind of magic when I notice this feature in Dropbox.
Oh,
when
yeah.
You get rid of a file. Dropbox supports a very fundamental form of or very basic form of versioning.
Yeah.
And then if you replace a file, you can step back in time. But even if you delete a file, I believe for a certain amount of time, it will let you undelete it. Yep, so you may want to consider. Okay. So you may want to consider either getting the freebie or depending on the amount of storage you need, getting Dropbox for these folks and asking that they use, put the project files in Dropbox. So if they do accidentally delete it, they can go to Dropbox and recover it again within the 30-day time frame.
For small files, that works. If it's huge graphics files, Dropbox, of course, by nature of it, uploading everything to the cloud might not. It may or may not be. So yeah, there you go.
Sure.
So,
but I thought that was neat one time because I think, you and I use Dropbox to, coordinate the show. And I think one time I had a brain fart and I deleted the folder of stuff. And I'm like, oh no, Dave's going to kill me. And then I went to the server and it's like, oh yeah, you just did this. And there was a choice, undelete.
Yep.
So save my bacon at least once.
All right. Tracy writes, and Tracy will help us migrate from questions to tips as we wrap up the show for today. But Tracy writes, I have a question about Time Machine taking way too long for backups. Backups on my iMac can easily take 30 minutes or more for just 5 to 10 megs worth of files. For instance, when the computer has only been used to check something online between backups, I'm using a 1 terabyte iOmega Mini Max attached using a FireWire cable. I noticed this problem when my backup drive filled up, which was around the same time that my logic board needed to be replaced. I've tested the cable with other drives as well as just copying files on and off the iOmega drive. All seems to be fine. The only time there's a slowdown is with Time Machine. Any ideas on what the issue might be? So, it's possible that your Time Machine backup is either corrupted or almost corrupted, and the system is constantly having to do kind of a rescan of the whole thing each time. The way you would know this, because it will not tell you directly, is to open up the console and just do a little search. You can filter. I would go to all messages, but just do a filter. Type the word backup, and that usually will show you things because backup D is often the process that will spit out these messages. And you'll see as it starts a backup, you'll see, finding the drive, selecting how many files it needs for backup. And if you see at some point in that where it says, deep scan or deep traversal of the backup, that gives you an indication that should not happen every time. In fact, it should only happen very rarely.
Oh,
right. So if you're seeing that, I think you've got a problem. And unfortunately with Time Machine, there's no real repair option for backups. It's blow it away and start from scratch, which always scares me because you have this period of time where you have no backup. So if you can clone to something else, at least in the interim, it does mean losing your history with Time Machine. And I don't know, depending on how you manage your life, that may or may not be an important thing to you, but I think my guess is that's what's going on, Tracy. John, I think you went through something like this recently, right?
I did. Yep. So I have two suggestions. Number one, you may want to go to the Time Machine menu and hold down the option key and say verify backups. That I think will do a integrity check on your backup file and may tell you if there's a problem. The other thing is, I had this problem and eventually I threw in the towel and I wiped it and did a new one. But I would see the message, Dave. So you're absolutely correct. If you see this deep traversal, that means that what is on the Time Machine and what's on the hard drive. For some reason, Time Machine thinks that they're way out of sync. And then, yeah, it'll look at every file on the source drive. And yeah, that takes a real long time. But the other message I saw was waiting for index. And I don't know if it was because I migrated from Snow Leopard to Lion, but it seemed to happen more often after that. But it was taking so long is that I would see it, yeah, for a relatively small amount of data. And I would see the message in my Time Machine menu as well. It would just say waiting, and also in the console. But I would get that message sometimes for 10, 20, 30 minutes. And then it would eventually get around to backing up the files, which in, you know, like in this case, a lot of times I would have backups that were very small on the order of, yeah, 10 or 100 megabytes. So I think what happens is also the file gets so complex and so complicated that you got to start from scratch. And that's what I did. I wiped it out and I created a new one. I, you know, hooked it via Ethernet and let it run overnight because, you know, I was backing up many gigabytes.
Right. But right.
That's my observation slash advice.
So Tracy mentioned that this happened after the new machine came. And Tracy writes, as a little advice for your listeners, if I ever need to take my computer in to be worked on again, I will first deauthorize my computer from iTunes. Over the years, due to recycling computers at home and at work, I reached my 5-computer limit. When my logic board was replaced, iTunes asked me to reauthorize the computer, which it could not do because there were 5 already, including the one of the logic board I no longer had. Ended up doing a deauthorize all, not a big deal, but it could have been avoided. This is excellent advice. When you send something or bring something into Apple, especially if you're under Apple care, a replacement logic board is something that happens a lot. It is an easy way to fix a lot of problems and oftentimes is what you need. But there's so much stuff tied to that motherboard. Yeah. And the iTunes authorization is one of them. And it's really not a big deal to reauthorize your computer for iTunes. If nothing has changed, you get it home, you reauthorize. It's no big deal. If the logic board has changed and you've deauthorized, it's also no big deal. You just reauthorize. That's it. So the process is the same. But if you haven't, then yeah, that's it. You can't go through and selectively deauthorize a computer you don't have. So the only way to do it is to go into your iTunes account, deauthorize all, which you can only do once every, either once every 6 months or once every 12 months. So definitely that's good advice. I like it. So thank you. Thank you, Tracy, for sharing that along with us.
Yes, and you can do it once per year.
Okay.
And I have the article in front of me, which I'll link to, of course. But well, I think they'll do it again, but then you got to call them and you got to beg.
Right, right. So while we're talking about doing tips and sharing stories of genius things and interesting things happening with Apple service, Jeff shares a story which we'll share with you. He has been going through an issue with his MacBook Pro, I believe, and there's some issue where this machine kept crashing when he was playing games or doing anything with video. And it was pretty obvious, at least on the surface, that there was some problem with the graphics chip. So with that in the background here, he says, let's see. I made an appointment at the Genius Bar. They ran hardware diagnostics and found nothing wrong. I was sent home and was suggested that I wait for a software update. Headed home to another couple of crashes and another phone call to set up a second Genius appointment. This time they wouldn't make an appointment for me unless I agreed to pay the one-time service charge. I asked for a supervisor since it was the same problem ongoing and was greeted with a dial tone. By this time I was a little on the frustrated side, but tried to maintain professionalism. I scoured the forums on the Apple support site and found some folks that were suffering the same kind of issues were having good luck by sending an email to now CEO Tim Cook. This is not my normal MO, but I thought it might be worth a shot. So I crafted a respectful letter and hit send. That very same day, I received a call from Apple Executive Relations and was assigned a Genius appointment for a replacement logic board at no charge. There was no mention of exactly what it was, but it was communicated that the logic board replacement will take care of the problems you are experiencing. I dropped the machine off and a week later went in to pick it up. Before leaving the store, I fired it up and within 5 minutes, I had crashed twice in the same manner. This time was with a completely fresh install of Lion on a presumably fresh motherboard. The Genius finally saw it happen and looked quite surprised to see it bomb the way it did. He spoke to the genius gods, and I left with a replacement machine of the current generation. I still don't know exactly what the issue was, and another phone call with the executive relations folks kind of confirmed that there's an issue. However, they would not name the exact cause. Though it was a little on the frustrating side and took longer than I had hoped to get things resolved, I have an extremely hard time being upset at the outcome. Apple once again made sure that I would continue my loyalty by the way they took care of me. And this fits in with a note that we got from one of our genius listeners that basically said, you know, treat your geniuses with respect and honesty and you'll get the same. So, you know, factor all this together. And this certainly isn't the first time we've shared a story of Apple replacing a machine or that the executive relations or customer relations department helping out a user. But they are there and they do stand behind their customers. So the moral of this story is, A, be polite, but be persistent and let Apple, give Apple the chance to help you, because as these stories that constantly resurface prove, they will. And if you're reasonable about it and you're not asking for something that's totally, you know, off the charts, and a new computer is not off the charts. John and I have both been through experiences, which we've told you about, where we've gotten brand new machines because there's been some problems, and it really isn't that difficult. Again, as long as the circumstances support it, Apple will do it. So just bear that in mind, to stay persistent with support problems. So that's Jeff.
I learned something new. I didn't know about this executive relations.
Well, that's the customer
number.
That's the customer relations team. And it's the same team. It's either executive relations or customer relations. They may have changed the name of the team, but it's the same people. It's not Apple Care. It's not support.
So is the lesson here to write to Tim Cook if you have a problem?
Certainly writing to Tim's, you know, fast track this, but I also think that just calling again, if it gets to this point and you have to have gone through support at several times, probably three, is sort of the minimum. But once you've gone through that, call the main Apple number, which I think is 408-996-1010, and ask for customer relations and make it clear that you're not looking for customer support. And if they say, we don't know who that is, now ask for executive relations or the office of the president. It's all the same thing. And most large companies have these. These are like the top level customer service ninjas, right? And they're just there to keep customers happy is really what it is. So they look at what you've claimed and they'll go through. So I think to fast track here, I think Jeff could have called that department and gotten the same resolution. Of course, having Tim tell that department what to do helps. So perhaps this is the right answer. I don't know. It's probably not a path Apple wants to set as a precedent. But, you know, I think Tim Cook inherited that job with the precedent being, if you have a problem, just email the CEO, you know, because Steve Jobs certainly was known to be that type of guy. So,
and Dave, did you say 408-996-1010?
I did.
Good memory, man.
Thanks.
Because if you go to www.apple.com/contact, and you know, hats off to them for making URLs that make sense. That lists all the contacts, up in the upper right hand corner of that page. So that is their main telephone number, which I guess it has been for years, if you remember it.
I was talking to him about some stuff the other day. So I got, that's the number I know on my cell phone. It's like, oh, it's Apple. Presumably Apple PR calling, but you know, probably someone at Apple. So that's the number. All right, let's share.
It's not Halloween quite yet.
Oh, it's not. Let's share this little tip from our friend Scott, and then we'll wrap this one up.
Hi, John and Dave. Another quickie on 355. Well, this should be quicker than the last one. I found a good way of keeping and managing the serial numbers from all the software that I've used and downloaded, and also helps me keep an inventory of those that I've paid for. And that is using 1Password. 1Password has a section where you can keep all this information. And what I do is that 1Password database file is backed up to the cloud using Dropbox. So if something should happen, the 1Password file is in Dropbox. I reload, re-download 1Password. I have a separate text file with 1Password key in it that's separate. And then it just unlocks that particular file, and I can go ahead and install everything. And one of the key issues is getting all those numbers right. Well, once you have them electronically, 1Password lets you copy and paste them into various places so you don't have to worry about sitting and typing all over again. However, Microsoft Office, being the pain in the rump that it is, the copy and paste won't work, so it's the only one that you have to go in and heck by hand, hoping that you get every one of those little four-lettered things correct all the way through so you can re-engage Microsoft Office. But this is a good feature of 1Password and another reason why everybody should own a copy. Yes, John, you should own a copy too. This is Scott, DC, a little shorter, signing out under 2 minutes. Bye.
Thanks, Scott. Now, I never thought about using 1Password like that, but that's a fantastic little tidbit of advice.
Yeah. My system's a bit less organized.
Yeah.
Most of it is email, dude. Is that I got the keys in my email and I just back up my email. Some of them are screen snapshots in my pictures folder. And some are in Notepad? Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so my stuff's all over the place. And some of it is, believe it or stickies. I still use stickies for some of my data. But believe it or not.
I recommend putting it all in one place. It doesn't matter.
No. You see, that makes it too easy. You know, because now, Dave, I got the sense of adventure when I need one of these pieces of data. And also, some of it is still on physical media. I still have, a lot of it is still stuff that I had from CD, you know, like Office, for example. Well, one is a screen snapshot, but I have older versions of Office where the code was on the case for the CD.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm just a mess in that respect. So I should really get my act together.
Yeah.
So I thank you, Scott, for your suggestion. I'll be sure not to take it.
Now, you mentioned a sense of adventure, John, and it made me think of what I've been dealing with at the house for the past week or so. Our dishwasher has gotten to the point. Listen, this thing, there's a bit of technology in
it. Oh, yeah. You said you were looking for the next big thing, and so your old one's on the way out.
Well, it washes dishes fine once you get it to run. But the thing is, most of the time, if you just press the button to start the cycle, it starts like in the middle of the cycle. So you have to press some combination of the keys to convince it to start at the beginning. So it's half like you're diffusing a bomb, because if you press the wrong button, it starts in the middle of the cycle and you got to like stop it don't cut the red wire.
You could try to get a new control board if you can even find one and figure out how to replace it yourself.
I could. That's right. But the other part is it's like hacking a password every time, but it's a rotating code, see, because it's not the same sequence of keys that I have to press to get it to reset back to
And can you
one.
Tell, like, by the sound that it
yeah.
makes, whether it's, all right, so whether it's at the beginning or the middle or the end,
yeah.
all right, so you...
So it's fun every day.
You know, I gotta say, don't replay...
I'm the only one in the family that is willing to do this. If the family wants to run the dishwasher, you know, they'll say, "Oh, the dishwasher's loaded. We need you to go touch it." I'm the only one that'll start.
And you got to think about it, Dave, because I mean, once life gets too easy and you get into this routine,
yeah.
where you can find your CD keys easily, and when you turn on your dishwasher and it always does the same thing, life kind of gets boring.
It's boring. Yeah. So we spent, I don't know, whatever it was, $800 or whatever on a brand new dishwasher. But the problem was with dishwashers, it's not here yet. It'll be here in a couple weeks or whatever, a week. But, you know, my complaint was, if I got to go spend money on a dishwasher or any new appliance, I want some cool new feature, especially if it's, you know, it's been like, you know, 10 years or 15 years
or whatever.
So, but there's
how
no
many
features.
New features?
That's the thing. It's just a stupid dishwasher. So I obsessed over the one thing that's gotten better in the last, 10 years, and that's sound. So we bought a Bosch dishwasher that operates at 46 decibels. Now, I think our current one is about, I think our current one's probably in the 60s. Most dishwashers are between 55 and 60. For those of you playing along at home, every 3 decibels doubles the sound. So we got 46. Nice. I guess. I don't know. It's like, you know.
I got a pretty crazy new GE one, and I would say the only features that are important to me, so there's a wash and a light wash. So if it's full of grimy stuff.
Family.
Okay. Yeah, it's just me, so unless, you know, I've been, you know, really messing up the dishes, I'll typically do a light wash. Otherwise, I'll do a wash, and the only thing is sometimes maybe I'll do high temp rinse or wash. If it's really grimy stuff. Other than that, I mean, yeah, as you're saying, I mean, though I saw online, you know, the conversation, I mean, yeah. I think they even have now, like I've seen Samsung, for example, is introducing some web-connected appliances, but
I don't
maybe
need my...
maybe for your refrigerator it makes sense. It could, you know, suggest recipes and stuff based on what it thinks is inside of it. But for a dishwasher, do you really need to know? You push the button and you need to know what it's done at the most part.
That's right. We like the delayed start feature, so we made sure to get one with that.
Mine has that, yeah. I think it's 2, 4, or 6 hours, you can say. Well, yeah. Why would you want to...
This one will go 19.
Yeah.
Well, it's actually nice for a loud dishwasher, and of course, this might not matter. And we will wrap up the show here, folks. This is usually post-show conversation. I don't know why we're doing this here. But anyway, with a loud dishwasher, it's nice to say, you know, do it while I'm asleep or whatever, and I'm not in the kitchen. But with this one at 46 dB, it might not matter. But okay, so for those of you that want to contact us about anything, preferably about the Mac and what we understand if you need to rant about your appliances, because obviously we do that here, you can email us at feedback@macgeekgab.com.
And I will reiterate that, Dave. It is feedback@macgeekgab.com.
feedback@macgeekgab.com, unless you are one of our premium members, and then you can email us at premium@macgeekgab.com.
What is premium, Dave?
$25 for 6 months. Gets you 2 extra episodes a month, access to all the archives, that warm, fuzzy feeling you get from supporting myself and John, and access to the email premium@macgeekab.com. And we really do appreciate those of you that have been signing up and those of you that have been signed up. It's truly an honor and a pleasure to
thank you
to produce this show for all of you, those of you premium and everyone else every week or more often as the case is. You can also call us 206-666-GEEK, which is 4335.
What?
Right? I cut you off on that, didn't I?
You stole my thunder.
I stole your
thunder.
And
you just stomped on the band.
I know. It's crazy. Well, I'd get the band going again.
You got one more strike. Come on.
Okay.
Mess something else up.
Let me screw something else up. So you can go to facebook.com/MacGeekGab. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. And when you go there, we've been having some discussions. I would say the other methods we mentioned for submitting questions are good, but hey, it's Facebook.
Yeah.
Go for it. But Facebook will show you when the podcast comes out, when the show notes are complete. And also, if you want to post on our wall, you know, come over there, like us. You know, the more the merrier. And it's just another aspect of the Mac Geek Gab community.
All right.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
What else? Oh, and speaking of community, well, the other thing, I mean, you and I and almost everybody hangs out here, right? But Twitter. I am John F. Braun. He is Dave Hamilton. Pilot Pete, who is piloting somewhere, is Pilot Pete. The podcast where you can get podcast news is MacGeekGab and MacObserver, all on Twitter.com.
We'd like to thank Michael Johnston from the We Have Communicators podcast. He converts this show to AAC for you. It's a great podcast all about the iPhone, iPad, and iOS stuff in general. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. And our podcast marketplace in October includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Text Expander from Smile, BB Edit from Barebone Software, Gazelle at gazelle.com, And I think I'll be at Blog World Expo, but I'm not sure because the sessions with podcasting have been, frankly, kind of a mess this year. So I don't know if I'm speaking, and I think if I'm not speaking, I'm not going to go, but because I've got other crazy stuff scheduled. But Blog World Expo is there, and you can get 50% off an Expo Pass with Observer 50. All that's through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. That's it, John. Let's get out of here. Right? Before I screw something else up.
No, you did good.
Well, you know. I'm tired today. I know I don't sound it. I sound like a maniac, but
you're always a high energy dude.
I know. It is what it is. Thanks again, folks. We will be back on Thursday for premium episode 357. Between now and then, have fun. Don't get caught.
Made up.